With me today on the guest, Beverly Ortiz of Angry Tias and Abuelas of the RGV. You can find more information about their work and this organization as a whole at angrytiasandabuelas.com, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Hey, sit back, take a listen, maybe take some notes. Beverly Ortiz is going to be filling us in on what this wonderful organization is doing for those people who are along the U.S.-Mexican border, those people who have been seeking asylum and who have been rejected in many cases, have been living at the border in tent cities for 2 years. Take a listen. Thanks for joining me. Hi, Beverly. Thank you so much for being with me here today. I'm really excited about the project that you work on, Angry Tias and Abuelas of the RGV from the Rio Grande Valley, which is, of course, near and dear to my heart, being that I'm from Harlingen myself. And just seeing your pages on social media of the actions that you're taking for this project, is just at the same, it's heartbreaking, but at the same time, it's very inspiring. It's heartbreaking to see that that is happening in our country. Can you tell me how Angry Tias and Abuelas came to be?
You know, thank you for us having this platica. It really has a lot to do with this current administration and the response that they've had to immigrant families and to immigrants. And so the Tias that started this group were reacting as humans to what they were seeing. And what they were seeing here locally in the valley is that folks were being, dropped off. Migrants that were coming and crossing for miles and miles of travel were being dropped off at the bus stations in McAllen and Brownsville and Harlingen without any clue as to where they were headed or how to get to their families. And so you looked at, images and videos of folks in bus stations with families headed to go see other families without any direction or without any help, without any money. A group of them started coming together and trying to figure out how to provide water and food and money and backpacks and just clothes or just basic, necessities. I think what moved a lot of us in this work, was the sounds and images of the children that were being detained in cages. And if you remember that, that famous video or sound where you hear a little girl crying out for her mom and children crying at a detention center, is what really moved a lot of us in this group to do more and to figure out how we could help a group of folks that were so in a very vulnerable situation.
So, question here, the people that you were talking about that were being dropped off at bus stations and being dropped off looking for their families, Were those people in the process of being deported?
Those folks were being in the process. They were processed and then essentially being moved to be with families or being with other folks.
Being with now, families here in the U.S.?
Here in the U.S.
Okay.
In the U.S., yes. Now, the folks that we have been working with more have been, once the administration put in a program called NPP, okay, which essentially a migrant can come in up to the border and ask for asylum or want to go through that process. And all of their case has been adjudicated in Mexico.
I see.
And the Mexican, protection protocol. And so that's when we saw families that were in Matamoros specifically and in Reynosa, but more Matamoros, where they came up and they did all they needed to do to the frontera, said, I want to seek asylum, and essentially were turned away and said, you got to do all your whole process in Mexico. And so what you found is families that had nothing, only the clothes on their back, if they even had that. And that's when we started to work with other groups or other folks that were living in the area to start to figure out how to provide food, how to think about water, you know, all of the things that you would think about that you need for survival.
So they were basically, so they were basically stuck between two governments.
Yes.
Trying to fulfill the requirements in Mexico, which they did, get to the border saying we did what we had to do. And then they're thinking we're going to complete the process here because that's the usual process, right? Mm-hmm. But then they said, no, you can't do it here. Go back and do it there. But by then, they've run out of resources to travel back or do anything.
And the thing is, they've got to stay in that area because they did, you know, start their paperwork for asylum, right? They, like, they got their register that they reported themselves and all of that. So they've got to stay in Mexico, and they've got to stay close to the border because they have court dates coming up. So they have to they do have to present themselves, right? And so the work of the Angry Diaz, along with Team Brownsville and along with other allies, was to figure out how to figure out basic needs, housing, you know, tents, water, food, medical care for folks. And from that grew a group of just, you know, different organizations that have come together both locally and internationally to come together to provide support, Catholic Charities as well, provide support for these folks. So you have, like, at least now you have between, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 folks living in an encampment in Matamoros. And we're talking rough encampment. We're talking rough camping, right?
Right.
No running water, no light. They live in tents. It rains like crazy. You know, right now it's hurricane season. There's a lot of flooding. And these are the conditions folks have been living for about 2 years now. And so that's been some of the work with this part of it, of the encampment, is making sure people have the basic survival needs, along the border.
So I know you have a lot of support, like you said, locally, nationally, and even internationally. What are some of the comments that you get from those who don't support your work? What are some of the biggest misconceptions?
I think people don't understand what exactly is happening, and I don't think people know, like, what all the different process is for somebody to do an asylum case, you know? I think there's been some, the local Mexican residents have at times were supportive at the beginning of the migrants coming into their community, and now have been like, how long are these folks going to be here, right? It should be a temporary situation, and it's been now like 2 years. Where are these folks going, and what's happening to these folks? And I think those have been some things where, like, questions around how long they're going to be there, why are they there?
So when you say the local Mexican folks, are you saying people on the Mexican side of the border are complaining?
The Mexican side of the border, yes.
Okay, what about people in the valley, people on this side of the border?
You know, I think the people in the valley, I think we have got some support from folks about what's happening. I think there's also folks that have not been as supportive to folks coming in from other countries. And what does this mean? You know, comments of what does this mean for our resources? What does this mean for our community? You know, it's going to strain resources if we have more folks coming in.
Is there any proof that it's straining resources?
You know, I think we're not here in the U.S. They're not in the U.S. They're actually in Mexico. And there's organizations providing for their food and for their care, from donations coming from individuals and donations coming from foundations, donations coming from different places. I think in the valley, you know, I don't know how much of they're not here, you know, and if they are here, if they've managed to cross, they're in a situation where either they're at the detention center, which is a whole other piece of it, right? Or they've managed to go through the process, they're with their sponsor, right? They're living with a family member or friend who is sponsoring their time while they're going through the whole process, immigration process.
Now, since this started like 2 years ago, Have you seen any of those cases actually move on, or are the majority of them still stuck?
For the folks in Matamoros, I think they've had a number of, there's like three hearings that you do in the process. Right now, folks are getting to their last and third hearing. And so what we have seen is very few cases that actually do have a process for them to come to the US. I think we've seen more cases where it's been denied, asylum has been denied. And so that's the period of time that we're getting into now.
What are the numbers like in Matamoros and Reynosa, those people in encampments, how many do you guess there are, or do you know there are?
I know about Matamoros. I don't know as much about Reynosa, but Matamoros is about 1,500 to 2,000 folks that are there. Now, I'm not giving you an exact number because it's an influx, right? People leave, people come in. People are still coming into the encampment or arriving to Matamoros. And so it's always an influx. So it's between those numbers.
Where do you see people coming from the most?
All over. It's essentially Central America, also Chiapas. We get a lot of folks coming in from there. We have Cuban folks. We have folks from Venezuela. So it's just all over. It's a mix of very different people.
Now, you work with the Angry Tías and Abuelas. You work in the detainee project, which is now we're talking about the detainment centers on this side of the border, where those images where you were describing with the children in the cages, that's where those images are coming from, correct?
Yes, but we on the detainee project work specifically with the adults, not the children. There's another organization dedicated to the children.
Okay, and so how do those two interface, and some of those adults might be the parents of some of those children?
I think that's where you. So a couple things. I think if they've all come together and they were apprehended together, there's detention centers that are family detention centers, and so those are further not they're not in the valley, right? The ones that we have here in the valley are adult detention centers, and then we have like centers for unaccompanied minors,
I see.
right? And so it's there's a big difference in terms of those pieces, right? Our work really is working with the folks that are detained at Port Isabel Detention Center and at El Valle Detention Center. And so these are young guys that have come, all different places, who have been there for, a period of time, were detained, whatever way they were detained. And what we try to do is try to arrange for, one, to figure out what their asylum case is, what they've gone through, what support legally that they need, and so it's trying to figure out do lawyer support, what kind of support that they need. There's also an adopt asylum seeker, which we have volunteers adopt a detainee and provide, emotional and monetary support during the time that they're incarcerated, and we figure out how to find lawyers and figure out how to find sponsors for many of these detainees.
So
So,
you said there are two locations, one in Port Isabel and one in the valley. Where in the valley is the other one?
well, the Port Isabel one is in Los Fresnos, and then the El Valle Detention Center is in Raymondville.
Okay, and these are male and females?
These are male, adult.
Oh, all male adults. What happens to females that are
There
detained?
is a female one, and another organization works with them.
I see. Well, I'm glad to see that it's, addressed differently for women. I'm sure there are so many different needs that are different between the two groups. Now, if people want to help in this project, in the detainee project, what would they have to do? What would you have them do?
The best thing is go to our website, angrytiasandabuelas.com. There you will see, you'll read what we do, what the different projects are, and you can fill out a volunteer form. Once you fill out the volunteer form, then we will, you know, we'll, you'll well, somebody will follow up with you on how to help out.
At these two detention centers, about how many males are detained at the time?
You know, because of COVID that's happening right now, the numbers are really moving, like smaller, shrinking. And so we don't know the accurate account right now.
But are they all asylum seekers? Or like you said, they're detained for different reasons?
They're detained for different reasons. We specifically work with asylum seekers. That's the work that we want to focus on. But there are folks that are there for many different immigration reasons. And not all of them are asylum seekers.
Okay. All right. This is so much information. I'm so glad I'm talking to you to find this out, because I think there are a lot of misconceptions, especially, you know, you lived in Chicago before, and being this far from the border, it seems like we play a game of telephone by the time the information gets to us. Even though we do have social media that we can look at it right away, it seems to be different when you read it and don't see it in person.
Yes, very true.
Can you think of any situation where you, in this process of helping, that you have seen that really impacted you?
You know, I think right now the work that we are doing in the Matamoros encampment has been the most eye-opening. The challenges right now with COVID-19 is that we haven't visited the encampment since mid-March. And so think about all the logistics of figuring out food and water and, you know, tents and all that for folks from afar. Although we have folks in the camp who are leaders of the different countries, it's very challenging right now to see the day in and day out the workings of how what's going on in the camp when we can't go visit due to COVID, you know. So I think that's been the most challenging piece right now, is trying to figure out how do we continue to do the work of providing physical needs, of making sure we're making sure people are good at the camp, what are the needs there. From far away.
And how do you do it? How do you do it from far away then? How does that happen?
Well, there's a number of nonprofit groups that work together. And so on the food, we figured out, you know, we have in the camp, there are four community stores that provide and have food. People go there and they, you know, you need diapers or you need whatever. You can go there and pick some up. What we did with the food distribution is we essentially started ordering the food. We knew what it was. We started ordering for a month to have it stored, and then have the store managers help distribute. The other piece with other allies is providing breakfast, lunch, and dinner for folks, is working with local restaurants and locally buying things to be delivered there at the encampment. It was good. It shifted into some more local, folks stepping up and being able to help out.
And when you say local, it's always from both sides of the border, right? I mean, being that you're right on the border.
Yes, both Matamoros and Brownsville, yes.
And so it sounds like these encampments have started to become like an organized community, so to speak.
You know, it's very, it's self-organization. There's leaders that have been elected from each one of the countries that's present. And the store managers are folks that people respect within the encampment. So they have their meetings, they discuss what are the needs. There's actually a women's group that popped up of women leaders who are like, our needs are not being addressed. And we, you know, we want to have a voice in the leadership discussion. So it's things that happen naturally within, you know, just within the needs that pop up within the encampment.
And it's good to hear that they are coming together in an organized fashion. I think a lot of times people have a misconception that it's a group of people just waiting to be helped or waiting to be given things to survive, but it sounds like they're very proactive in their survival and in meeting their goals every day.
Yes, I mean, and you know, it's very proactive. And for example, when masks are needed now, right? Mm-hmm. There was women that had skills in sewing who were like provide us the materials or figure out, and we can do this for the camp. And so they were making masks for little kids and for the adults. And it's just things that they look at, like, what are things that we want to make sure that our camp is moving forward. There's teams that clean the camp, like each country or each section. 1 week is responsible for clearing up the camp and making sure that it's clean. So there's a lot of self-organization within themselves to figure out what are our needs and what do we have to do.
And what about the children and school for the past couple of years?
So, for now, there was this, it's similar to what's happening in our, you know, for us is like the parent is responsible for the education of the child right now. Because there's educators from Brownsville in the Valley that were going to do classes and have classes with the kids there, the kiddos there. And they had supplies and they have, you know, rulers and paper and all of that. That had to be, of course, shifted to providing the supplies, but having the parents work with the child on creative crafts or reading or any of those things, because there's no social activity that's happening right now in the camp. Like, all of those things have ceased, right? Before COVID, there was a group of educators from Brownsville who were working with the kids there, identifying some of the migrants who were teachers, right, or had education background, mm-hmm. to teach, to have classes there on the camp. Right now, none of that is happening because of COVID.
Right. And have you heard of any COVID cases in the camps?
There was recently, about a week ago, one case and other people that have been tested and are in isolation. So we're waiting to hear where that's at. There is a medical group that's present at the camp that created an isolated area for any folks that had symptoms or any folks that have tested for COVID. So we do know that there's one person that has tested and there's folks that are in isolation right now. I think they're waiting test results for that.
And that seems kind of
separate from the camp.
It seems kind of low for the amount of people there. Is it because of the testing not being so readily available?
No, it's more the fact that once stuff was happening here in March, like, they were not letting anybody go in. And they being the Mexican immigration government, not letting anybody go into the camp that wasn't living in the camp except the doctors that are there.
I see.
It took a little bit to get the test into the camp, but they really were like, nobody's coming in to the camp that they don't already know, or nobody's coming in from the outside. So all of us that are from the different organizations that are volunteers, we haven't been going, you know, and we've been doing everything via, you know, phone or, you know, Facebook chat or video or whatever, to make sure it minimize on that front.
So it sounds like the Mexican government is kind of protecting the area or kind of isolating the area?
The area itself is isolated. I think it's just they made a decision where it's like, we don't want anybody coming in. We have volunteers that come from other parts of the country or other, you know, other countries. And we've actually had to stop that. We stopped that and a lot of the other organizations from having any volunteers coming in from other states. And then just not having any volunteers coming into the camp, you know?
So even the asylum seekers aren't able to leave the camp, say if they wanted to work?
That's a big question right now. They have been able to go and do that work. So they've been able to leave to go to work. I think where the cases are really high right now, I think that's being reduced. But I don't know if that's completely shut down that yet.
So I've seen some of the images from your website. I see that the tents that they use at the Matamoros camp site, they're really more like makeshift tents, right? I mean, there's just so many people. I can imagine that it's difficult to get everyone like a proper tent.
the tents are, you know, regular camping tents, nothing particularly fancy. I think when it does rain and you know, they have they have carp areas, so there's much, it's much thicker for fighting off the rain.
Yeah.
But as I told you, it really is rough camping.
Yeah.
No running water, no light. You know, they're not good conditions. Never a good place to be, whether it's raining or cold or any of. There's not a good, you know, it's not a good place to be.
What about showers, bathrooms? How do you handle that there?
So, ourselves, along with other allies, have put in money to have porta potties. Mm-hmm. The Mexican government created showers, an area for showers. We don't think that they're enough. There's also areas where people can wash their clothes that were essentially built for folks to be able to do that. But again, it's a very rough camping situation.
Yes, it looks very rough. Sounds really rough. I mean, I feel like these asylum seekers are so resilient, you know, sticking it out as long as they have. It just makes you think how bad the situation must have been for them to risk it all and end up here where they find themselves. Now, before I let you go, I really want to know more a little bit about the detention project. Those asylum seekers that are currently in detention centers in Los Fresnos and in the other detention center in the valley, you're demanding that they be released, correct?
You know, here's where we stand. We don't think anybody should be detained. We should free them all. They have not done anything that is, you know, that's criminal. And so for both the detention, the ones that are there and detained, the young kids that are unaccompanied minors, the families, we don't believe that families should be separated. We don't believe they should be detained. They shouldn't be incarcerated. They have not done anything that's criminal. And that goes for anyone that's in the detention center, you know. Our take on it is they should free them all.
So are they being detained awaiting some kind of hearing, or why are they being detained?
They're waiting to get their process. For one, some of them have already applied for asylum, so they're waiting to get their hearing. The hearings now are all via video more than anything else, right, due to COVID. So they're waiting to hear what their, you know, what the next steps are in their asylum case.
So the alternative would be for them to be released and maybe go to like an encampment or just live somewhere close by where their hearing's going to be while they wait for the hearing.
I would say they should live with their family or live with a sponsor while their court hearings are happening instead of being detained.
What is the benefit of the government keeping them detained? Like what?
You know, there's a lot of money, and if you think about the cost per detainee per day, you know, I think I read somewhere it was like $700, right, per detainee per day. Imagine if you have, you know, 300 in one site. You know, most of these folks minimum are doing, you know, are there 6 months.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a piece of that. And then they're just the government, there's an administration right now that really wants to put as many obstacles so that people can go back or get deported back to their country.
But in the meantime, they're being exposed to COVID. They're separated from their families.
Yeah. Right. And I think the Port Isabel one, there was an article, there was actually a story done, I think in June. The number of cases that were popping up of COVID in Port Isabel and how they were reporting that. You know, last I had heard, this is about 2 weeks ago, though, it was about 60 folks in there that had tested positive. And so, you know, the vulnerabilities, like there's folks that are in that detention center that have, you know, health issues that are very delicate, and they shouldn't be in the space where they're going to get COVID, you know, which makes them even more vulnerable.
Right.
And so that in itself is like, you know, it's horrible. It's inhumane.
And, you know, and a lot of people want to use the argument, well, what if they have a criminal record? But I think it's pretty easy to check if someone has a criminal record. before you release them, and whether it was just someone seeking asylum was waiting for a hearing.
Right. Exactly.
So that, you know, I don't see the basis for that argument. So it's so great to be aware of the ins and outs, the intricacies of what is going on at the border. There's so much misconception. People, I think, imagine immigrants coming in like, you know, mass coming in and just being like chaos. But it sounds like these asylum seekers have found a way to organize and make the best of the situation where they find themselves. And that's, you know, that I don't think that's talked about enough. And then also there are so many organizations like yours who are coming together to just fulfill a need here and there, where when you put them all together, it's creating the opportunity for survival.
Yes. And I think at the end, you have to see these folks have traveled as families. They did a long journey even before they got, you know, to the border. Their journey was really long, and they had a lot of danger, you know, a lot of not knowing, right, whether they would make it to the border. And once they do, it's like the resiliency to be here, even being in those camp conditions, those rough camp conditions, to seek a much better life than that they had in their country, for them to have and have their kids and have their families in these rough conditions, tells you a lot of where, you know, where they're coming from or what they've gone through, you know, yes. And the dangers of just all that they've gone through to be here, right? And it's just shows there's the strength and the love for their family to want to do more and want to have a better future for their kiddos.
You know, and unfortunately, we're living under an administration that is not supportive of you know, people seeking a better life in our country. It's, you know, we see it around us where there's so many instances of people just boldly being racist or boldly saying statements like, go back to your country, you know, things like that, that are just hurtful and unfounded, because I think these kinds of demands or comments come from a place of not having knowledge. Like, if we built up on knowledge on what is really going on in not just at our border, but further beyond, mm-hmm. Why are these people leaving their country? Why are they feeling the need to risk it all? And why is it our responsibility to help, to be, you know, more open? A lot of people want to brush it off as saying, well, it's not our problem, but we are a global economy and we can't forget that. So I thank you so much, Beverly, for being with me today. Thank you for you know, just giving me so much to think about and ponder and pray about, because I think we're living in very rough times, not just with what's happening with our asylum seekers, but now we have to deal with the pandemic and you trying to help them amidst all that. So bless your heart. Bless the tías and abuelas that have changed the canvas, you know, of what could be. I like to think sometimes when we say we're angry, we use the energy from that anger to direct it to something more positive. And I feel that's what you're doing. And I commend you for that. Thank you so much for all
Thank
that you,
for
do.
Your time. Yeah.
And I'll be following you, and we'll be hopefully talking sometime in the future. Hopefully when all this is done with the pandemic, I would like to come down to the valley, come down to Matamoros, and see what I can do in person.
That would be great. You'll be welcome.
That would be my dream, I think.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have a great day.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.